Our environment is so complex, and our wetlands are a crucial element of our ecosystems, and they're very fragile. And you know what? I think all of us need to take a hand in helping preserve them. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Lucky to have a great organization like the Wisconsin Wetlands Association working to educate the public and to give the knowledge and tools to protect and preserve and appreciate our wetlands. Katie Belfus has been with us many times from the Wetlands Association to talk with us, and we're going to visit about their upcoming conference and sort of what the biggest threats to our wetlands are. She's joined by Cal DeWitt. Cal's a longtime advocate for the environment in Wisconsin. Really looking forward to visiting with them and talking wetlands with them and with you. So you stay with us. We'll be back with our guests right after this look at the news. Stay with us.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Loretta Lynch, President Obama's nominee for Attorney General, is striking a conciliatory tone at her confirmation hearing in the GOP-majority Senate. If confirmed, she would be the first black woman to lead the department at a time when tensions are increasing between law enforcement and minorities following the deaths of unarmed black men. Today, Lynch pledged closer ties again.
If confirmed as Attorney General, one of my key priorities would be to work to strengthen the vital relationships between our courageous law enforcement personnel and all of the communities we serve.
Critics argue the current Attorney General, Eric Holder, aligned himself more with protesters of excessive police force than with members of law enforcement. The Obama administration has reversed its decision to tax a popular college savings plan that benefited millions. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports the proposal backfired after critics pointed out it would hurt middle-class families.
Roughly 12 million families rely on so-called 529 college savings plans, which the administration had argued benefited mostly wealthy families earning more than $200,000 a year. But Republicans and Democrats in Congress argued that families with much more modest incomes also rely on 529 plans. Families, on average, put away about $175 a month. That money, which can total nearly $20,000 tax-free by the time a young child is college age, can significantly reduce families' reliance on loans. The White House conceded that resistance to its proposal had become a distraction and would instead focus on expanding the $2,500 yearly tax credit for college costs. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
And the dig out continues as much of New England tries to recover from the fierce blizzard that clobbered much of the region this week. NPR's Stovia Smith reports Boston is slowly reopening for business.
We're beginning to turn the corner, is how the governor put it, but the dig out is hardly done. Ice-coated trolley cars are moving slowly over tracks cleared of snow, and nearly 2 feet was plowed off Logan runways, allowing some flights to resume. The driving ban has been lifted, but people are being urged to stay out of the city so cleanup can continue. Southeastern Massachusetts is coping with damage from severe flooding. Crews are trying to clear roads of debris, everything from chunks of homes wrecked by the storm to lobster traps whipped up after a seawall was breached. A fleet of utility trucks is being ferried over to the island of Nantucket to repair power lines. Heat and light has been temporarily restored to most by a generator. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
Stocks are higher following strong earnings from Boeing and Apple. Investors are also waiting for the results of the Federal Reserve's two-day meeting for indications on when the Fed may raise interest rates. Last check on Wall Street, Dow was up 55 points at 17,446. This is NPR News. Greece's new prime minister says he is considering a veto on further European Union sanctions in Russia. Joanna Kakissis reports from Athens that this pro-Russia stance sets the stage for Greece's first big confrontation with the EU.
All 28 EU member states must agree on sanctions for them to pass. The EU has already imposed visa bans and frozen the assets of some Russian officials over the conflict in Ukraine. Now the Europeans are also considering sanctions on technology, energy, defense, and banking. Greece has gone along with sanctions in the past, despite a close trading relationship with Russia. But Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras says his government may fight them. His new foreign minister, Nikos Kotsias, has pushed for closer ties with Russia and criticized Germany's domination of Europe. Germany supports pressuring Russia over the conflict in Ukraine. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Athens.
The ranking Democrat on the U.S. House Intelligence Committee is introducing legislation that would grant President Obama war powers to combat the self-styled Islamic State. California Congressman Adam Schiff says he wants to see the bill debated in Congress, saying lawmakers shouldn't wait for the White House to send over its own proposal first. Jordanian officials say their government may meet the demands of a prisoner swap with ISIS. The group is holding a Jordanian pilot hostage. A government spokesman says Jordan is prepared to release an Iraqi female prisoner who was involved in deadly hotel bombings a decade ago. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the investment firm of Raymond James, wealth management, banking, and capital markets. Learn more at lifewellplan.com. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate.
The Joy Cardine Show, The Larry Mueller Show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. These programs and many more are possible thanks to listener support. You can learn about programs, schedules, and so much more at WPR.org. Thank you. Support also comes from Monroe Street Family Dental, committed to being a patient-focused practice for the whole family in a friendly neighborhood setting. MonroeStreetFamilyDental.com, a patient practice.
Well, whether it's a marsh, a bog, a sedge meadow, or an ephemeral pond, we're surrounded by wetlands, and that's a good thing. They're critical habitat for many creatures, and they serve important functions. They're natural filters, for example, for our watersheds. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. The folks at the Wisconsin Wetlands Association educate the public and policymakers about the importance of wetlands while actively protecting these incredible natural resources as well. And really happy to have a couple of guests with us today to talk with you about wetlands. One, Katie Belfast, been with us many times, Outreach Programs Director for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. And Katie, great to see you again. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Larry.
Yeah, and also with us today, Cal DeWitt. Cal, Professor Emeritus at the UW-Madison Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. He's giving the plenary address at the upcoming Wisconsin Wetlands Association conference. And Cal, thank you for spending time with us. It's been a long time.
It has been.
But it's great to have you back.
You're very welcome.
Great to talk about wetlands and to talk about the conference. You know what? We do this practically every single time you're on, Katie, and let's do it again. It was just to identify what constitutes a wetland area, because we always get that question.
Well, and it's an issue that's really, as researchers like Cal and others have worked more over the years, we've learned more about what makes wetlands wetlands. But the three sort of core tenets are, does it have the proper soil, hydric soils, wetland soils? Does it have water at or near the surface of the ground for all or part of the year? And that sort of timeline thing is really important. And does it support wetland-loving vegetation? There's a group of wetland plants that have special characteristics that allow them to grow in conditions that are sometimes wet and sometimes dry.
And the theme of your annual conference this year, and by the way, it's in Madison for the first time for a while.
Yeah, we haven't had it in Madison for a long time.
And it's February 24th through the 26th. We have information up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Judith's got that up, lickety-split. But the theme is telling our stories. And why did you choose to focus on that this year?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And it actually has a lot of different meanings to us. As scientists, one of the most important things we can do is share the information that we learn with other scientists and with the public. We're telling the stories that we have learned. We're telling the stories that we share with the broader public and with decision makers about why wetlands matter and why science is an important part of the conversation about wetlands. And frankly, networking is one of the most important parts of this conference. It's a wonderful opportunity for people to share stories personally, one again with another, during the conference and build relationships and network with one another.
Yeah, so that theme is really carried out through the entire event, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
We're also telling the story of the 20 years of this conference because we are celebrating our 20th anniversary of this conference, and I'm so pleased that Cal is here joining us today because he's the progenitor of this conference. He first founded the conference 20 years ago.
Yeah, Cal, and that's wonderful. I'm trying to think back, but I bet anything you and I talked about this 20 years ago on the radio show. How did it get started? Let's go back to that. How did it get started, and what was the goal in your mind?
Well, I had been teaching a course called Field Investigations in Wetland Ecology for a number of years, and before long, I had this big cadre of students. They were local and regional and national and even international, and the time came when there were so many of us, we really had to get together, and we also had colleagues we developed in the Department of Natural Resources and other campuses, other universities. And so we decided that we should all get together. We did get some financial support for this through the Hewlett-Packard Foundation, and we started things off with a roundtable conference at which we shared ideas and and understanding, too, of these wetland systems. It was real interesting because at that point, 20 years ago, we knew a lot less than we do now. And we were able to share in excited ways things that we were discovering. And this inspired us all to do even more work and inspire others, too, by our example.
Just as an example, maybe if you can think about an example, what didn't we know 20 years ago that we know today? Can you come up with
Well,
one
of the remarkable things that I personally have been working on, and some others as well, is how the groundwater system works and how it feeds the springs and the streams that come into our wetland systems. Groundwater has been out of sight, out of mind for a long, long time. And yet it's absolutely vital to the health of the environment generally, but also for wetland ecosystems.
Yeah, so that's a very good example
there.
Talking with Katie Belfus of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association and Cal DeWitt, Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison's Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, about the work of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, telling wetland stories. You can join in with your questions or comments. Are you aware of the wetlands in your area? Have some questions about protecting them? For example, what concerns do you have? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or if you want to post a question and or photo on our Facebook page, go right ahead. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post your questions or your photos right there. You know, Mark in Ripon is online. Let's go to Mark. Hi, Mark. Thank you for calling.
Hi. We had purchased the property years ago, and it had a wetland down in a small wetland. And through the years, it has filled in. What can and can't we do to restore that?
Okay,
that's a great question, Mark, and I think it brings up a really important issue that I think Cal would agree with, that wetlands, one of the things we've learned over the years is that wetlands are intimately connected with the entire landscape and the entire watershed, and they don't exist separate from that. As we've developed more and more of our landscape for agriculture and urban uses, that has changed the way water flows across our landscape, and in some cases it means more sediment flowing off fields into wetlands that are at a lower elevation, and that's really tough. How do you get that out of there and move it off the landscape? That's my guess about what's happening in your property. I don't know for sure, having not been there. But there are ways that you can restore and remove some of those sediments. There are the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has a program to help, and NRCS as well, to help do restoration of wetlands and on private land. And sometimes that does involve bulldozers, because how do you get that soil out of there? The most important thing is try to figure out how to minimize future runoff, because if you just deal with the problem today without dealing with the reason for the problem, it's going to happen over and over. Mark, we have a new handbook that came came out last summer called My Healthy Wetland that helps landowners like yourself think about some of the issues that might be going on in your landscape and where you can turn for resources and support.
Yeah, that's a dandy little book, and you can get it through the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. I think we have a link to it.
There's a link to our webpage, to our homepage, and there's a link right on that homepage to the book, or you can call our office. May I give the number?
Sure, go ahead.
608-250-9971 is our phone number.
It was 608-250-9971.
Yep.
Is that it? Yeah. And you can also go to our Facebook page and get the link there. Through the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. And Mark, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's take one other call here. Jan in Burlington, your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm fortunate in that I have about 6.4 acres in the town of Burlington. About 1 acre is not part of wetlands, and that's what we landscape. But the rest is beautiful protected wetlands. We back up to probably around 30 acres of wetlands. But my question is this. You know, I would definitely always want to preserve it because of its natural beauty, and I realize its importance to the ecosystem. But on the other hand, I'm being taxed at full market value as if that's buildable land. And I was wondering if there are any tax breaks in the state of Wisconsin for our wetlands owners.
Cal, do you want to comment?
Sure. That's a fairly typical problem. The thing to do for you is to contact your town hall, talk with anyone there, and ask when the assessor will be available at the town hall, and arrange to meet with the assessor and just explain the situation. Many of these parcels of land that include wetlands have not really been evaluated in terms of their conservation value, and what you'll probably find is that your assessor will look at that. Perhaps you could bring some photos and information on what plants are growing there, and it's very likely it will be shifted to a conservation category, and your taxes therefore would be based upon what's there.
Yeah.
And Larry, if I can just add, we've done some work on this issue because you're not alone, Jan, as Cal mentioned. We've put together a publication called What Does It Cost to Own a Wetland? That's a property tax guide for landowners that helps provide some of the information that Cal just shared, but some other steps and folks to talk to. And we've also done some work with property assessors to train them on how to identify wetlands and what resources available to them so that they can bring that into the equation.
Ah, excellent. Jan, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Alan in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Alan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. A couple things I'm wondering about. So they have a new law now that they can, if they do some like remediation or create wetlands, they can cover over some of it. And what I'm wondering is how do we know that where groundwater is getting filtered in to the water table, and how do we know that people aren't covering that up? And once that, like, you know, the access to that spot is covered, like, there's no way for groundwater to get back into that. And when you just create a wetland, you're just creating a pond, to my way of thinking. It's not really doing any good for the water table. And the other thing I was wondering about is that there's lots of farmers that are drain tiling their fields more and more. And I don't know if there's any regulation that stops them from doing that. But, I mean, you know, it used to be water used to have to make its way out, either evaporation or, you know, so it would run off naturally or it would go into the earth. Now we're allowing them to just get rid of that water as fast as possible, and that water is basically going directly to the ocean, so it's not going into the water table. So I'm curious on your thoughts, and I'll take that
okay.
up here.
All right,
I can start off here.
Sure, go ahead, Cal.
On this. One of the most interesting things you can do in wintertime, especially after a light snow, an early light snow, is to go out across a wetland, just take a little hike, and look for areas that have free water. Later in the year, later in the winter, do that again. And these wetland springs, the flows, are generally visible very, very nicely then. And you can then flag them and look at them again in springtime and summer. And, of course, if you wanted to do a little aerial photography, which might be midwinter, look for black spots in the photos, which are where the spring water is coming out.
Good points. Katie?
Yeah, I just wanted to touch a little bit. I think what Alan was referring to early in his conversation was wetland mitigation, where if you need to fill an area of wetland in one place, you can, quote-unquote, replace it or restore wetlands in another place. It's good that there's a law that requires mitigation because that's better than nothing. But the best thing is to keep the original wetlands because we as humans are still learning how to restore what Mother Nature took thousands and thousands of years to figure out. So in terms of infiltration, water going into the groundwater, that happens anywhere that it happens in a lot of different places. There's not sort of a hole where the water can go through. But we need to keep as much of that as we can because we have so much impervious surface, roads and ceiling, roofs and whatnot, that we need to protect as much as we can of the remaining open watershed to allow that infiltration to happen. Because you're right, if we cover over land, we lose infiltration in that area.
One of the things that we have to recognize is that whenever we build houses, roads, sidewalks, parking lots, is that we're actually paving the earth. Mm-hmm. The rooftops are also a form of pavement. And what that does is it interferes with the percolation of rainwater and other precipitation into the earth. One of our first urges is get rid of that water. But if you get rid of the water, you do what Jay was saying, is you send it down to the ocean eventually.
Talking today, getting some great questions and some great conversation as we visit about the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, talking wetlands, telling the wetland stories, and taking your questions. Katie Balfus of the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, she's the Outreach Programs Director. Cal DeWitt is a professor emeritus at UW-Madison's Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, and he was the originator of the Wetlands Association conferences. It was 20 years ago. It was the first one and still going strong. We'll learn some more about that conference and, of course, take your calls at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller, Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about our state's wonderful wetlands with our two guests, Katie Balfus and Cal DeWitt. And lots of callers online. And let's just take another question here. And then I want to talk some more about the upcoming conference. But Bob and Franklin, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. A year and a half ago, we bought a property with ridges and a valley. And the valley has a small creek that runs through it, which is spring-fed. Previous owner had installed a berm to create a pond, and it's got a drain in it. So there's a small pond that it's kind of silted up. It's not much of a pond anymore. Is that something that should be removed and put back to the original condition, or is the pond a good thing? Is it like creating another wetland?
Mm-hmm. That's a really great question, Bob, and I think a lot of folks build ponds because they want to have more wildlife, and so that's that was a goal of the previous landowner. You, as the new landowner, have maybe a different goal. This pond's not working out so well for you, and you might want to improve the quality of the spring-fed stream. In many cases, it is the right thing to do to take out that berm and restore the stream. And maybe there were some small wetlands on either side of the stream because those kinds of communities go hand in hand. That will be something that you're going to want to get support for doing. There probably will be permits involved for the DNR because you're changing a waterway. So just bear that in mind. It's not a complicated process. It just is the reality. Again, I would recommend our handbook. It doesn't talk specifically about creek restoration, but it helps you think through some of the issues. And most importantly, to set your goals as a landowner. What do you want to achieve on your property? And then who can you talk to get some advice about the best way to go about achieving those goals?
Good.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Bob. Jay in Washburn, your turn. Hi, Jay.
Hey, Mary, thanks for taking my call. This is a great and very important subject, so thanks for having that. And I have a comment that leads to a question. Several years ago, when the Corps of Engineers was first challenged over their jurisdiction of waters of the United States, which, you know, in a lot of ways protect different types of waters. At the time, I did some research, and a lot of states had varying environmental regulations, and it seemed like Wisconsin had some very good and protective environmental regulations for water quality and wetlands. And I'm wondering if your guests feel that those regulations are still fully in place, or if they've changed over the years, if it's better or worse. And I'll listen off the air for this.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Katie, you want to take that?
Sure. Yeah, there was a Supreme Court case in the late 90s sometime that changed what the national government could regulate with respect to waters of the United States, which includes lakes, rivers, streams, and some wetlands. And it made a bunch of wetlands in Wisconsin that were not at that time considered to be connected to those waters of the United States. Some people call those wetlands isolated wetlands. It made those no longer protected at the federal level. Wisconsin was the first state following that Supreme Court decision that worked to reinstate those protections at the state level. And I'm proud to say Wisconsin Wetlands Association, working with a lot of our partners, was an instrumental part of making sure that improvement happened at the state level. So that was really great. And at the time, we were the go-to example of how to protect wetlands and water quality at a state level. There have been changes to those, generally to wetland regulations over the years. We have supported some of them. We have not supported others of them, and we're doing our best to work with the suite that we have now and really want to focus on making sure that we are doing as much as we can to prevent wetland loss and restore wetlands on the landscape.
Mm-hmm. And Daryl in Le Coup d'Oreille, it's your turn. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning, Larry and your guests. I'm wondering how Wisconsin would be affected by the Senate bill S-787, the Clean Water Restoration Act, introduced on June 18th, 2009, put forth by Russell Feingold.
Well, boy, I wish my colleague Erin O'Brien were on the radio with me today because she would be able to tell you exactly the answer to that question. I know it's an issue our organization has been tracking to try to make sure. I think in general we're a big fan of clarifying what's considered waters of the U.S. Definitely interested in making sure that there's a consideration of the roles that wetlands play at a watershed scale. And there's a ton of science backing this up, and there's been some really good work advocating for that. I don't want to speak to the current bill because it's not my area of expertise, but if you have questions in particular, Daryl, I'd encourage you to call our office and talk with our policy staff.
I was just wondering where it's at.
And Erin would know.
Yeah.
She's probably listening and saying, Katie, here's the answer.
Okay. Maybe she'll call in and let us know.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Sorry,
all right. Thanks
help.
So much for calling. Appreciate your call. And John in the town of Rome in Adams County has a question. Let's go there. John,
all right. Thank you for the great topic today. I'm a little bit curious regarding the new ferrous mining law bill. As I understand it, wetland destruction is allowed under that law, providing that mitigation takes place. Given that scenario up there in Iron County, is it a situation where the state is going to require the mitigation to take place in the same watershed that the water has been destroyed in?
Hmm.
Unfortunately, there is no such requirement that mitigation happen in the same watershed as the fill. That's unfortunate, in our opinion. I want to stress that it's not just the state of Wisconsin that has oversight over wetlands that might be affected by that proposed mine. The federal government also has jurisdiction or could have jurisdiction, and that's one of the issues that's being discussed now, is are those wetlands that would be affected both by the pit, but more importantly by where the spoils would be dumped in the next to the mine, are those wetlands in that area considered connected wetlands? I've been there. Our staff has spent a lot of time in that watershed, and gosh darn it, those are connected wetlands.
Yeah.
But they're very poorly mapped up there, and so there's a lot of work being done to document the wetlands that are up there. And I think the most recent news on this mining issue reflects the fact that the mining company and its consultants are realizing there's a lot more wetlands in that area than they ever knew. Because they've spent a little bit of time on the ground now. So they're pulling things back a bit while they study the options.
Well, there we go. Thanks, John, for calling. And Jim in Lake City, Minnesota, thank you for calling. Hello.
Yeah, thank you, Larry. My question is, on are there land trusts that will accept conservation easements from private landowners that want to protect wetlands, and is there anything being done along that line? And that could be done with on not only continuous but also wetlands that are separated and so on. Just like the lady they called in about the small acreage that she had and how to protect it and so on. And sometimes I know that that is one way where it's a permanent way of giving a an easement on your property and still own it and get some tax benefits from that and protect it even after it's being sold. So anyway, I'll listen to answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, Jim, for calling.
Yeah, Jim, the answer, of course, is yes. And adding to this yes answer is that it's a great way to conserve wetlands. It's also a great way for a landowner to protect a wetland not only during their lifetime but in successive generations. What a land trust is a selling or a gifting of the rights of a piece of land for development over to some agency. It could be a conservation agency or a land trust. So in your area, what you do is just look up land trust and then your area. And if you have difficulty in that, you can contact the Natural Heritage Land Trust here in Wisconsin, and they can give you some advice on whom to contact there in Minnesota. What happens when a land trust is created is that its worth, its value, is determined by an assessor before development and after development. In other words, what is done is the development value of the land is determined. And if you give that development land away to a land trust or to your local town or to a municipality, that land is devalued, and that is taken either as a gift in that amount, or in some cases, an agency will actually pay you that amount. A farmer, for example, can do that not only for the wetlands but for an entire farm and thereby gain a fair amount of income or a great tax deduction.
Mm-hmm.
And we're lucky in Wisconsin to have Gathering Waters Conservancy, which is our state's alliance for land trusts, and they also can connect you with any land trust across the state of Wisconsin. And land trusts have been a great partner for us in recent years, and we're really glad they're here.
You know, having a great conversation here today, and I bet a lot of the things that we've covered here and questions and so forth are going to be touched on and maybe discussed in depth at the conference that's coming up. And I just to go back to that for a bit, the conference is the 24th of February through the 26th, so Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday at the Monona Terrace in Madison, in Madison for the first time in quite a few years. So great to have that. And sort of at 20 years now, it's kind of a time to reflect. And Cal, I know you're going to give the plenary talk at the conference. And what is the title? Telling Our Stories, Time and Time and tempo in wetlands and wetland science. What are you going to cover there?
Well, wetlands are dynamic systems. Boy, do they change from year to year, decade to decade. And I'm going to deal with these wetland systems as they change naturally through the various permutations of climate, weather, peat deposition, and growth of various vegetation communities. So it'll be a beautiful presentation of these dynamics, mainly shown from aerial shots and local shots showing how these processes work.
That's going to be really cool. And there are, Katie, as well, there are other speakers, keynote speakers.
Yeah, we have three great folks from the Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies, which is one of our sponsors this year as well. We're pleased for that collaboration. We'll have Sharon Dunwoody, who's a professor emerita of journalism and mass communication, talking about how we best communicate these behavioral changes we want to see in terms of caring for wetlands and other natural systems. And we're having a banquet presentation on Wednesday evening, and Patty Lowe from the Department of Life Sciences and Communication is going to come share the story of a documentary film she made with several youths from the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa about preserving their natural resources and threats to their watershed up there. So I haven't seen that film, and I'm really looking forward to that presentation. That's open to the public.
Yeah, and again, that is open. And when is she speaking?
She's speaking Wednesday the 25th in the evening.
Wednesday the 25th in the evening, and that's open to anyone.
That's open to anyone. It's a ticketed event, but we welcome anyone who'd like to hear more about that story.
And again, you can go to the Wisconsin Wetlands Association website. We have a link on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page to learn more about getting signed up for the conference and also the various events as part of it. And kind of a cool thing this year, too, because a lot of people are coming back who are some of the early, you know, they're the first time around, and here they are coming back.
Yeah, it's fun. We've got, I know of someone from Kansas and someone from Massachusetts and somebody from Louisiana was supposed to come on up, and I don't know if that's going to happen, but it's really great to see some folks. A lot of it has to do with a love for Cal DeWitt right here, but also a really passionate commitment to wetlands in whatever career they've gone on to have.
And, you know, a lot of the benefit of that comes from the not only from these great speakers, but just from the chance to sit and talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've got more than 80 presenters sharing results and information from their work, and lots of time for people to chat and share stories one-on-one.
Terry in Green Bay has a question. Terry, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning. I'd just like your guests to comment on this store that was built by the Cabela's in Green Bay. I know just a few weeks ago I was discussing this with a gentleman in the Green Bay area. He's had a store of business in Green Bay for close to 60 years. And from what he understands, they pushed through, or one of the reasons that they got to push through that store where it's built on the wetlands on the west side of Green Bay, one thing they did was they donated $70,000 to Ducks Unlimited to help push this through. And I was wondering, how did they get that store built there like that?
It's something our organization worked hard to not have happen. We did a lot of work on that when that issue was before us. It went through because of special legislation that was passed that exempted that site from whatever the rules that other people needed to follow. I don't think that's how our law system should work, but that's what happened. And there is a wetland. There is a store there now. They did provide money to Ducks Unlimited to do wetland restoration. That's good. I don't think it was a pay-to-play situation necessarily. Wetland restoration is a good thing to do, and Ducks Unlimited does great work. But it is unfortunate that that wetland acreage was filled. There's not a lot of wetland left in the city of Green Bay. Most of that city was built on what would have been wetlands once upon a time. So every acre that's left is really vital for providing the natural benefits that wetlands provide for us. So unfortunate loss.
Yeah. Thanks, Terry, for calling. I want to give Joe and Osseo a chance to join us, too. Joe, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me. My wife and I have a small grazing dairy, and we have low areas. It's in a driftless, northern edge of the driftless, that are being overtaken by smooth brome grass. We've tried to use the cows to control some of the brome grass. I've
my goal is to try and get more forbs, more flowers. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what other techniques could be used, because the cows, basically, if you release them in there, they sink in the swamp. They're too heavy.
Approach I have been using, Joe, is to interplant in my smooth brome. And the way I do that in my own wetland, which is Wabisa Wetlands near Madison, is to establish a plot fairly close to the house where I'm growing prairie and wetland forbs. And then I'll take chunks of those and put them in amidst the smooth brome. And I find that most of the time it's competitive. Heavy mowing of smooth brome also will diminish its strength. One of the ways to deal with that is as soon as it's up, mow it, and then mow it again. Just have it take all of its root stored nutrients, put them into the green, and then cut them off. I think maybe Katie has additional information. The Wetland Book is a good one to look at.
And somebody asked, what is a forb, too? So.
Oh, a forb. A forb is a broadleaf plant in contrast to grasses. Mm-hmm. And forbs are usually a little less abundant in grasslands, and often those are the ones, too, we really like because they have flowers. So forbs are... there's a really wide range of those. Echinacea is one of these. The prairie coneflower is another. Many of them, if you look up a list of forbs on prairies and wetlands, you'll find a great resource. What I do in my own area is to collect seeds from areas where these plants are growing, start this side garden, and then do the transplants. You can also seed amongst the smooth brome, and I have found that smooth brome often is overcome by the plants that you put in.
Hmm. Good.
Katie? Great answer. I don't have a lot to add to that, but thank you for paying attention to the fact that there's one plant that's growing in an overabundance, because that's an important thing to keep track of.
Yeah, absolutely. We have more callers online. Appreciate your call. But I want to go back to the conference for just a minute or two. The conference is, again, in February. The dates are February 24th through the 26th. You said there's how many? 60?
We have something about 80 presentations between oral presentations and poster presentations, and we welcome anybody who's interested in learning more about wetlands to attend. It is a scientific conference, and so folks will be talking about research and data, but there's a lot of other opportunities for learning more about wetlands, and we welcome anyone to attend, register to attend.
And I want to get one more question here, one more question in from Deborah, who wondered about a watershed. We were talking about watersheds, and she wondered what is a watershed? How do you define a watershed?
Well, a watershed is an area that in which, if there's any rainfall, the rainfall always drains within that particular system, and there are watershed divides. Where the rain, which would fall on the right, will go into one watershed, on the left go into the other watershed. So a watershed is the area that drains a specific stream or a set of streams.
Mm-hmm. And there's watersheds come at different scales depending on what you're interested in. It could be the watershed of your little creek, or the watershed of your river, or the watershed of Lake Michigan. So it depends on what scale you want to talk about. But Cal's exactly right. It's where the water that lands on that area will drain into a particular water body.
Well, this has been really a lot of fun, and I know you're going to have a great conference. Thank you both so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
You're very welcome.
Appreciate it very, very much. As we talked about wetlands, the Wisconsin Wetlands Association, and the conference on February 24th through the 26th, go to our Facebook page. It might be the easiest. Just get a link. You'll get a link there to the Wisconsin Wetlands Association and the conference itself. If you want to participate, I think you're going to be more than welcome, and you're really going to enjoy what you have to hear. So great to have with us Katie Belfus from the Wisconsin Wetlands Association and Cal DeWitt. from the UW-Madison Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. And, you know, it's always inspiring to hear stories about the wetlands that we have and the science behind and the work being done on those wetlands. Coming up next, we're going to talk about gas prices, oil, fracking, how they all fit together. So I hope you'll stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.